Carol Burnett was one of the original queens of television comedy. Her long-running variety show offered a warm wackiness that parents let their kids stay up late to watch. Carol Burnett looks back on those years in her new memoir, This Time Together.
I loved putting on wigs. I loved blacking out my teeth.
Making funny faces. Do you just getting a laugh makes it worthwhile?
Yes.
So, naturally, when Carol Burnett sat down at the mic here at our studios at NPR West, she was completely game when I asked her to reprise her trademark Tarzan yell.
Shall I back up?
What's the worst?
Well, let me see what happens. Did I blow anybody's head off?
I don't think so.
That wasn't a particularly good one, but it was okay.
There's a story in the book where you went into Bergdorf Goodman.
Yes.
Fancy department store
yes.
one. Well, you were quite famous. You were a household name by that time.
Right. We were in New York, and I was headed for rehearsal. We were doing a special, and I needed some stockings. And I went up to the lingerie department, and there was this lovely lady there. And she said, oh, hello, Miss Burnett. And all, very lovely. And I said, oh, may I write you a check? And she said, I'm sorry, but I'll need some identification. And I said, well, you know who I am. She said, I know, but it's the rules. We have to put down the driver's license and, you know, all of that. So she said, wait a minute. Let me check with the floor manager. And finally, she said, Miss Melton will approve your check if you will do the Tarzan yell in the middle of the lingerie floor. So I said, well, okay. Nobody else was around, so I did it. Right behind the sales lady, there was an exit door that burst open, and in came a security guard with a gun pulled.
Seriously.
I mean, we could have had our heads blown off. So I learned a lot that morning.
In 1967, the Carol Burnett Show started, and you were surrounded by these really funny people.
Well, I guess I'm in the seat right behind you there. I'm in the no-frills section.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah. A lot safer back here.
Good.
You ever hear of an airplane backing into a mountain?
Tim Conway, Harvey Korman, Vicki Lawrence. Would you say, looking back, that there was an innocence about the humor? Or is that not the word?
No,
there's something about it that feels...
I think sometimes we were pretty edgy, but I never purposely wanted to hurt anybody or get edgy without really being funny. You know, sometimes that happens. You'll sit and you'll watch something, and it's very clever, but there's no belly laughs. And I always love the belly laughs.
Excuse me, are you in the no-frills section?
Yes.
Well, then get your foot off our rug.
I like the physical humor. I'd do my own stunts and never knew how. I'd jump out of windows, get dragged across the floor, all kinds of things.
One of the best-known continuing sketches in the show was you, Vicki Lawrence, and Harvey Korman portrayed as a family.
The family, yeah.
You played Eunice, and Vicki Lawrence played your cranky mother.
And I wouldn't be here right now if Mama hadn't started whining for me to take her out.
I did not whine.
You just shut up or I'll take that little rubber stopper out of your purse and ram it down your throat.
It was a highly dysfunctional family. Actually, I loved it because there were no jokes in it. It was all about the premise of the sketch and the characters and how they would react to certain things.
You write in this memoir that some of Eunice was based on your own mother.
Yes, because none of her dreams ever came true. And she touched my heart, even though she was horrible. My mother wasn't horrible, but she was very vulnerable, and none of her dreams came true. Eunice always had these dreams and ideals that she was going to be somebody. And I remember when she got on the Gong Show.
Who knows, I might just get a television part or something and just have to stay out in Hollywood for a while.
A television part? Eunice, you are nuts.
She thought she was going to move to Hollywood and become a star and everything. And, of course, they gonged her before she got three notes out. And it was so sad. We got fan mail on it saying that it made him cry when it just went into Eunice's face. You could just see her starting to cry. And it was a heavy piece.
There's another skit that involves one of the other ensemble. That's Tim Conway.
Oh, please.
This involves Mr. Tudball. and his secretary, Mrs. Wiggins.
Yes. I was kind of a bimbo tending to her nails in this push-up bra with this floral top and a pencil-thin skirt.
Do you have any estimate of the time that those doggone nails are going to be dry?
No.
They're beginning to attract the fruit flies.
The thing with Wiggins and Tudball is that we never rehearsed it because Tim would always change the dialogue. That's why on the show, if you see me as Mrs. Wiggins biting my nails, I'm trying to keep from laughing.
The show actually, you're right, was criticized because the actors, all of you, mm-hmm. might crack up, break character, and especially when Tim Conway was doing
generally, that. I would say 90% of the time it was Tim. He would just crack everybody up, and I totally understand the criticism, but it was never like, let's break up here.
Well, but the audiences loved it. In the sense that you kind of were all in on the joke.
Yeah, the audience was in on the joke because they knew Tim was doing something that he had not done before.
I'd like to end our conversation with the way you ended your show. Mm-hmm. You had a small little song that you sang mm-hmm. at the end.
My husband Joe wrote that. Here we go. I'm so glad we had this time together, just to have a laugh or sing a song. Seems we just get started, and before you know it, comes the time we have to say so long.
Well, I'm sorry to be saying so long.
Oh, thank you, Renee. I enjoyed it.
Carol Burnett has gathered together tales from her life in her new book called This Time Together. And for those who remember that dress, that famous curtain rod dress from her spoof of Gone with the Wind, relive the moment at npr.org. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Custodians have become prime targets for school districts in a budget pinch. To save money and teachers, many systems around the country are beginning to outsource their custodial work. But in many schools, custodians play their own educational role. From member station WPLN in Nashville, Blake Farmer reports.
At Carter Lawrence Elementary, south of downtown Nashville, students love to work with Mr. Preston Birdsong.
I help wash the table.
In his nearly three decades here, Birdsong has seen eight principals come and go. His longevity earns him respect as a disciplinarian.
Hey, come out of there, John. Boy.
The boy stares at the floor in the apparent shame of getting caught sneaking to the bathroom.
You through? Okay. Do your hands and go.
While stern, Birdsong says he's careful not to come down too hard.
When I first became head custodian, we had a meeting and they told me something that kind of stuck with me. Be careful how you treat the kids because you might be the first smiling face they see in the morning time and the last smiling face you see in the evening time.
Birdsong worries that smiling face won't be his come fall, but that of someone with a private cleaning company who's not quite as committed to children. Thousands of custodians around the country are in the same position. At least four school districts in New Jersey are considering outsourcing. So are systems in Fort Wayne, Indiana, Ann Arbor, Michigan, and others. Nashville's Board of Education plans to privatize more than 600 custodians to save a projected $5 million. Leaders of the Service Employees International Union beat drums outside the district's central office in Nashville. Michael Thomas says it's an insult to be laid off, only to be hired back with lower pay.
We'd lose everything. Only thing we would be getting is like scraps to a table that goes to a dog.
Custodians in Nashville schools make an average of $13 an hour.
We know that a lot of our custodial staff are lower wage employees.
That's Nashville's superintendent, Jesse Register, who says the district is doing what it can to help. Current employees will get first dibs on the outsourced jobs, and like privatization efforts in other cities, Register has asked that the contractor include a retirement plan.
There is some loss of benefit there, but what we want to do is minimize that so that people still feel good about about where they're working and the fact that they are continuing to work in hopefully many of the same jobs.
In Southwest Florida's Collier County, many custodians did stick around after their jobs were outsourced a year and a half ago to save $3 million. Michelle LeBute is an administrator there.
The downside obviously was in the beginning when some employees were taking a cut in pay. The employees were no longer in the Florida retirement system. But in terms of the district, our services are as good, if not better.
If there's no sacrifice in service and the savings are real and sustained, school finance experts say outsourcing makes sense, especially if the alternative is cutting teachers. Gary Price isn't giving up his job, but this second-grade teacher says custodians like Preston Birdsong aren't just mopping floors.
I think of him as one of the couple of people at the school that sort of hold the whole school together.
Because of that goodwill toward many custodians, some districts wouldn't touch outsourcing in the past. With years of budget cuts behind them, school systems now see privatization as one of the least controversial ways to make up a deficit. For NPR News, I'm Blake Farmer in Nashville.
This is NPR. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. Danielle Trussoni's new novel, Angelology, is a cross between The Da Vinci Code and The Name of the Rose. It's a mystery and a thriller about the blending of angels and humans into entirely new creatures. For our series, Three Books, where authors talk about three books on one theme, Trussoni works with a very different kind of blend, food and the French.
Once upon a time, it was fashionable to adore the French. In recent years, Americans have given Francophilia the cold shoulder. But I contend that there still exists a population of Americans who secretly love France. Here are three books to help Americans step into the kitchen. Escargot may not be the most amusing of company, but Talk to the Snail, Stephen Clark's witty guide to understanding French culture, is a hilarious and chatty window into the Gallic soul. From navigating Paris's rude waiters to making sense of the ever-confusing cheek-kissing, Clark's writing is so fun that you'll find yourself wishing to jump on a plane to Paris, tout suite. This novel's sensual prose and the intimate relationships that form in a cooking school will satisfy the pickiest foodies out there. Even the passages about vegetables managed to be alluring. The tomato was more horizontal than vertical, with ridges running from top to bottom along its sides, ready to burst. After a five-year hiatus in France, Thomas Jefferson returned home to America with a taste for French dining. And so it was only natural that, when tensions ran high between his fellow statesmen, Jefferson invited them to dinner. Cerami's Dinner at Mr. Jefferson's examines one dinner in particular, a 1790 feast Jefferson organized to smooth negotiations between James Madison and Alexander Hamilton. Monticello was famous for many dishes, but Jefferson's ice cream was legendary. By the end of the evening, the men had agreed upon the course of the nation's foreign policy and the location for the capital. These three books are enjoyable ways to enter into a state of Francophilia that Americans so readily shun. After reading them, you might find yourself trying out some rusty French phrases or buying a poodle. If the mood strikes you, you might even be so bold as to wear a beret.
Danielle Trussoni is the author of Angelology. To comment on this essay, go to our website, npr.org. California, like many states, is suffering a shortage of nurses. How short? 10,000 vacancies and counting. But the problem is not a shortage of people who want to be nurses. Most are trained in the state's community colleges. And as Elaine Corey reports, these nursing programs are forced to turn away thousands of qualified students every year.
The Nursing Skills Lab at Contra Costa College, a community college east of San Francisco. This looks like a real hospital ward, complete with high-tech instruments and monitors. But instead of real patients, the beds are filled with life-size mannequins used by students to practice procedures.
Put your hand on the catheter tip, okay?
A half dozen students are huddled around instructor Sean McNeil, learning how to delicately insert a catheter.
Advance it how much further?
1 inch.
Another inch, okay, right. Now remember, this hand is dirty.
Yeah,
keep these hands separated.
These students are a highly selective group. the rare ones who were accepted into this two-year associate degree program. Once they graduate, they'll sit for the state licensing exam to become registered nurses. It's a goal Kimberly Hall thought she'd never achieve.
I felt it was near impossible. I was getting ready to give up.
Hall is finally in, but only after 3 miserable years of waiting. The problem was never her grade, says Hall, but a simple lack of space.
You have 300 people applying for 30 spots, and rejection letter after rejection letter, it starts to wear on you after a while.
California has 75 community college nursing programs, and every one of them is full. Many have a 3 or 4 year waiting list. Others, including Contra Costa, rely on a lottery system, which requires applicants to reapply every year. Program Director Marianne Werner McCullough.
I advise every student who walks in through the door to be sure to apply to 5 or 6 programs. I tell them to get a map and to apply to every place in that area that they can and hope for the best.
There they are. Transcripts, applications, notes, ready to reapply for next fall.
Lisa Hill has taken that advice to heart. College application season just ended, and Hill has a thick folder of forms to show for her efforts. She's been inching toward nursing school for years, having aced all her prerequisite courses at Contra Costa and then applying to the nursing program last year. The school accepted 70 students, including a dozen who made it onto the alternate list. Hill was unlucky number 13.
When I didn't get in, it was a shock, really. I was devastated.
For now, Hill's vocational dream is stalled.
I heard, wow, what a great career to get into. The population is getting older. There's going to be a need for nurses. Nurses are retiring.
And so Hill won't give up. At less than $5,000, a community college nursing degree is a true bargain. And California is trying to address the backlog. Hill does have another option. She could attend a private nursing program at a for-profit school, such as the University of Phoenix. In recent years, market-based or proprietary programs have moved in to fill the gap left by overwhelmed state schools. That should surprise no one, says California's Community College Vice Chancellor Jose Mian.
If I were in the position of a proprietary school, I'd take a look at those same numbers that you're looking at, huge demand, not enough supply, and I'd say, here's an opportunity. And I'd offer the same thing at a high cost.
Nursing is an expensive program to run, what with low faculty ratios and high-tech lab requirements. So for-profit schools do cost more, up to 10 times more than a state school. Lisa Hill says she hates the idea of running up a huge debt, but if she doesn't get into a public program soon, she may not have a better choice. For NPR News, I'm Elaine Corey.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
And now back to golf. That's most likely what Tiger Woods wants to do after yesterday's press conference at the Masters tournament. Tiger Woods had avoided an open question and answer session since the scandal in his personal life broke late last year. From Augusta, Georgia, NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
It was built up as Judgment Day. The world's press, or at least the 200 or so reporters who could get a ticket for the interview session, finally would have their moment. Who, what, why, and more with Tiger Woods. In a move that would have made a cornered politician proud, Woods walked right by the TV cameraman waiting outside the media building near the back entrance players normally use. He walked through the front doors and acknowledged a few reporters as he moved through the crowd toward the dais.
Sorry, Benji.
Woods took his spot behind a microphone. The only sign of menace was his early growth of a goatee. His tone was friendly and relaxed, even when a couple of questions probed the mysterious November car crash outside his Florida home that ignited the scandal. Why was he taken to the hospital?
Yeah, I had a busted up lip and a pretty sore neck, and that was it.
Was his use of the prescription sleeping medicine Ambien involved in the crash? A hospital report said he was admitted as a possible overdose.
Well, the police investigated the accident, and they cited me $166, and it's a closed case.
closed case applied to several of the subjects discussed worldwide for the past few months. Not once yesterday did anyone utter the words sex or affairs. There were no questions about an alleged payoff to one of his mistresses, no in-depth questioning of whether his inner circle knew about his behavior, something he steadfastly denied. There were questions about his relationship with a controversial Canadian doctor who's been linked to banned performance-enhancing drugs, or PEDs. Woods acknowledged he has used Dr. Anthony Gallia, but only for legal therapy on his ailing knee.
He did come to my house. He never gave me HGH or any PEDs. I've never taken that my entire life. I've never taken any illegal drug ever.
Woods was most expansive on the subject of his own failing. Interestingly, he seemed, as he has in other public comments on the scandal, at ease talking about his lying and deceiving and resultant therapy, albeit without detail.
I acted just terribly, poorly, made just incredibly bad decisions and decisions that have hurt so many people close to me.
Go Tiger!
Hours before he sat down in the interview room, Woods passed what he later said was his toughest test of the day, his first round back in front of golf fans. He made the decision to return to competitive golf at Augusta because of the potential for a soft landing. Indeed, walking the course yesterday during his practice round, Woods could have been walking on a pillow. The gallery that followed him numbered in the thousands and offered nothing but support. Augusta is a place of rules and good behavior, or else. When security guard who mingled in the Tiger crowd the entire round said there were no problems. No one, the guard said, had to be pulled aside, given a lecture, and a punch hole in their ticket. Two punch holes, and you're out. Jim Thornton of Tampa, Florida, wasn't surprised by the reception, but Thornton, an admitted fan of Tiger Woods the golfer, felt the cheering at times was hypocritical.
I just think some of these people are just kind of like, oh God, I hate what he did. Go Tiger! You know what I'm saying?
Woods liked what he heard. He smiled and waved, even signed some autographs. He admits the new nice guy policy may fade a bit come Thursday's first round of the Masters, because amidst all the change he says he's undergoing, the self-exploration and recommitment to core values, one thing won't change: trying to go out there and win a golf tournament. Tom Goldman, NPR News, Augusta.